That's the great thing about photography. It shows us the way we were, how we looked at one time, how we dressed, and it shows us where we came from, our history. And I think it's really important to have that memory, that document of how we evolved. I want to extend my body of work to new places and new ideas and new subjects and not kind of till the same ground over and over again. Life is short. I think you really have to make use of the time that we have here because, you know, the years just fly by and I don't want to squander what little time I have left. I want to make it count.
Join explorers and travelers on their journeys and discover distant places and fascinating cultures. From the highest peaks and densest jungles into the heart of adventure. This is Unfolding Maps with Eric Lawrence.
My guest today in this very first episode of Unfolding Maps is Steve McCurry, who is considered one of the best documentary photographers and visual storytellers in the world. He has been one of the most iconic voices in contemporary photography for more than 30 years, and his work can be seen on scores of book covers and magazines. It has been featured virtually in every major magazine in the world. He himself has more than a dozen books and countless exhibitions around the world to his name. He has worked on a huge variety of topics such as conflicts and vanishing cultures, ancient traditions and contemporary culture, and the red thread between all of this is his focus on the human element. In 1984, Steve McCurry became world famous with a photograph of the Afghan girl, Shabat Gula, with her piercing green eyes. This photo became the symbol of the Afghan refugees and one of the most famous National Geographic covers ever, and is to this day one of the best-known photojournalistic images in the world. Well, quite a few superlatives that went in there, but I guess in this case it's justified. In this far-reaching conversation that you are about to hear, Steve and me, we talk about his philosophy of photography, about exciting and formative experiences in Afghanistan and India, and about what drives him to continue his work today. Have fun with it and enjoy our conversation. Hi, Steve. Welcome to the podcast. It's great to meet you here in your office in New York, and I'm very grateful that you take the time to meet me.
Well, it's a pleasure. Welcome.
One of your many better-known quotes is this: the best pictures are the ones that tell a story, that take us on a journey. So for you, there is a close connection between a successful photo and a journey. When you look back on your decades of work, what kind of journey did you try to take the viewers of your photos on? What have you tried, in broader terms, to express through your work?
I think what holds my work together, or the journey that I've been on, is it's about discovering the world that we live in. It's about exploring this planet that we're on. I like to learn about different cultures. What's more important in life, in my view, what's more important than seeing this world and meeting people from different cultures? India, China, Russia, South America, you know, Antarctica. These are places I kind of dreamed about and fantasized about traveling to. So I think showing through my photography these places, it's been an incredible life, and it's exactly what I wanted to do from a very early age.
Is that the case? Did you feel this kind of curiosity already when you were a child?
From a very early age, from as early as I can remember, I wanted to travel and see the world. I had my uncle was in the Pacific during the war. I had an uncle worked in Panama Canal. My sister traveled in Europe. These were places that I kind of dreamt about, and I wanted to go there and see them for myself. You know, there's that expression or that saying that, you know, be careful what you wish for. I wanted a life of travel, and I've never slowed down. I've been traveling and going to different places for about 45 years.
Yes.
So, and I have to say, I'm as passionate about my work and about going to places and doing, you know, various things in my work. I'm as fascinated now as I was when I started. I just came back from Antarctica just last month, a place that I had read about and saw so many documentaries. So it was a real pleasure to be able to go down there and experience it for myself before, you know, before all the ice melts.
So you are driven by curiosity, and you always have been. I want to find out a little bit more about how the foundation for this was set. For example, one of the nicknames you had as a child was Steamroller Steve. How did you earn that one?
Well, as a child, I was very restless. I had a lot of energy. I was always dashing around. I was a bit uncontrollable. And I think that energy and that sort of, you know, uncontrollable need to move was what kind of led me later in life to want to move and travel. And my first real experience with travel was living in Europe when I was 19. I just thought, you know, this would be interesting to go there for a few weeks or whatever. And I ended up staying a year. I worked odd jobs in Sweden and Amsterdam. I traveled across Eastern Europe to Turkey. And that's really what hooked me. I thought, you know what? This is an amazing lifestyle. Whatever I do in my life professionally, I want travel to be part of it. And this is actually before I became a photographer. So as I went back to school and studied, I was kind of searching for, you know, what can I do that would allow me to travel? And I first was interested in filmmaking, and then through filmmaking,
you actually studied filmmaking.
Yeah, I have a degree in cinematography, and during that course, I started looking at photography, and sort of in the middle of that study, I thought, you know what, my personality is much more suited to still photography. Still photography allows you to kind of wander and explore kind of the serendipitous moment. Nothing's planned, nothing's organized. You just kind of walk around and observe. So it's a lot less pre-production, post-production than in film. And all you need is a simple camera. You walk out the door and you can start to work. So I got a job on a newspaper, and I never looked back. I did that for a couple of years. It got very monotonous, a bit boring. But my ambition was to travel, so I saved my money and got a one-way ticket to India. And there I stayed for 2 years continually.
What did you hope to get out of this experience to go to India with a one-way ticket?
Well, I wanted to go to India to start to do some serious travel photography. I wanted to photograph and travel. I thought India is such a visual place. It has so many incredible stories. There's different cultures. You're in close proximity to Nepal and to Sri Lanka and to Thailand and to Bangladesh, Pakistan, Afghanistan. So this is where I want to kind of base myself. I thought if I'm going to tell stories and travel, India is the best place to start because it's so rich culturally. So that's kind of where I started. And it was actually a really good move because from India, I was introduced to Afghanistan, which is what I would say was my big break. That story, it was really Afghanistan which helped to get me into the kind of the major magazines and to tell these international stories, which were pivotal and dramatic and historic.
You went to Afghanistan through Pakistan, actually, which is, I think, the next place after India that you went to. And in Pakistan, you made pretty significant contacts for your future professionally.
Yeah. When I was in my second year in India, I was there during before the monsoon. It was so incredibly hot. I said, you know, I have to escape the heat. And I decided to find a place where I could kind of chill. And I decided to go to Pakistan up into the mountains. So that was just a random decision. And when I got to northern Pakistan, that's when I met some Afghan refugees that were staying in the same hotel that I was staying. And they said, you know, there's this war going on in our country, which is right over that mountain ridge there. We can walk there in 2 days. So it seemed like, I thought, you know, that sounds like a real adventure. It sounds like an important story. I had heard about what was happening in Afghanistan. I never dreamed in a million years that I would go there or have an opportunity to do the work. But when they invited me to take me across the border, I kind of immediately said, sure, that sounds like a really important story.
Important, yes. But of course, you might as well have sticked to countries and cultures that we would consider exotic and that don't put you at physical risk. What did intrigue you about the idea of photographing this kind of a civil war?
I think what drew me to want to go there was that this human element, these refugees, and the fact that so many villages were being bombed. And I was literally kind of right there. I was right within a day's walk of witnessing this. And I thought, this is an opportunity. I'm in the right place. I have the right people to go with. I have the time. And I'm looking for an important story. And this was, I decided just to kind of go for it.
How did you cross the border from Pakistan to Afghanistan then?
Well, there were the best way to cross the border was just to go through the mountains by foot, off the road. I didn't use my passport. We just walked through the forest, and that was the best way to go. I was a little bit nervous. I didn't really know who these rebels were that I was traveling with, and here I'm going into a war zone with people I don't really know.
And you even dressed up as one of them, right?
These men gave me the local costume. I put that on. I had a beard. I had my head shaved. I had the local hat. So I looked almost exactly like an Afghan. I mean, you couldn't tell any difference. And I went there. I was there for, I don't know, 3 or 4 weeks. No communication, no roads, no electricity, no running water. But it was a life-changing experience, what I witnessed there. I had never worked in an area of conflict. I had never seen a shot fired in anger. And here I am witnessing these two sides locked in this death struggle, the Afghan army and these Mujahideen, these rebels who were mostly farmers and shepherds. But they were upset because the government, in their view, was trying to turn – they saw the government was against their religion, against their way of life. They were taxes that they didn't agree with. There was all these range of disputes that they had, and they just decided to take up arms, and they went toe-to-toe with the government forces. And as what happened, the Russians got very nervous, and they decided to step in and on the side of the government. And
That was the Russian invasion in 1979, right?
The Russians invaded around Christmas 1979, and the world was shocked because suddenly there's tens of thousands of Russians in Afghanistan, and it appeared that the game was over. But these Afghans just were persistent, and they powered through it, and then they started getting, you know, billions of dollars in aid and weapons from the West, particularly the United States.
And you found yourself as more or less the only working photographer on hand to shoot this invasion, right?
Back in 1978, 79, when this insurgency really got kicked up into high gear, there were very few photographers or journalists that were covering the story. I happened to have all – I was there. I spent about 2 months before the Russians came in. So I had all this material, all these experiences, which very few other photographers had. So I was sort of positioned very well when the Russians invaded and suddenly the media, the world's attention turned to Afghanistan. And I had all, I was ready to go. I was there. I had photographs. I was making new photographs. And I was starting to get assignments and work from various publications and whatnot.
And you spent quite a bit of time as well with the Afghan Mujahideen. You already mentioned them. Would you talk about that a little bit? And how far did you have the chance to accompany them?
Well, back in those early days, the Mujahideen, the Afghan resistance, was very eager to have foreign press come in and tell their story, whether you were Japanese or Indian or from Europe or the States. So we were embraced because they wanted kind of their side of the story told. So we went in, I went in maybe 20 times to cover various areas of the country. They were very hospitable, although I didn't speak their language. There was always somebody that had a little bit of knowledge of English. I learned a little bit of Pashto. So it was, again, it was a bit scary going into this area. You know, you're deep in, you know, 4 or 5 day walk and you're completely out of communication. There's no roads. If there's any, if you get sick, then you just have to be, you're totally on your own.
There's no emergency exit from the situation.
There was nothing. There wasn't even a bicycle. You had to go either walk or go by horseback. And that was it.
Were you aware of this level of risk back then? Or do you think from today's perspective, it was also a little bit naive maybe?
Well, there was a bit of naivete, but I was also, I was young. I was looking for adventure. I wanted to cut my teeth on a very important story. So I was willing to take that risk, take a chance. And, you know, that youth energy and whatnot, I think, played into that whole kind of wanting to go off on this adventure. And it was a dramatic story, a story which, you know, the world wanted to know. So it was dramatic times.
And it was your first, as you just have said, experience of this kind. How did you figure out on location in the situation that quickly how to take impactful photos of such a kind of conflict? What did you try to show about it?
Well, I think it's trial and error. I think you learn by experience and you learn very quickly one of the most important points, the one of the most important things, to have a really good fixer or translator or guide, because you're literally putting your life in their hands. If you end up going in the wrong area or getting into some place, it can really be a question of life and death. So it was kind of feeling my way, trying to see, you know, what's working, what isn't working. I didn't want to get, obviously, you want to get close, but you don't want to get so close that you get, you know, stuck in some kind of a bad situation.
How did you make this judgment? What is close enough, but not too close?
One of the things about these Afghan fighters at that time was that they were not very experienced themselves in guerrilla warfare. So I kind of felt at times that they were willing to die for, you know, their religion and their country, and they were willing to take crazy risks. But, you know, this wasn't my religion or my country, and I wanted to come back in one piece. So I always had to evaluate, do I want to go with this group or that group? Do I want to go to this place or that place? I don't want to go on a suicide mission. I want to be close. I want to be close to the action, but I'm not a combat photographer. I was never, but the purpose wasn't to show kind of bang bang. It was really more the human story, the people who are caught in the middle of the conflict, the refugees, the people whose villages were being destroyed. That was what concerned me and what interested me. It wasn't the combatants. They sort of had a choice to fight and decide where to go. These refugees or these people who were caught in the middle were just stuck, and often they were in a very precarious, dangerous situation. Suddenly their homes are destroyed and they're literally sleeping out on the ground, walking with their belongings over these mountain ridges. So it was a dramatic situation.
How did you make sure you got your material out of there safely?
When I would leave Afghanistan to go back to ship my film or to get back into civilization, I had to walk across the border into Pakistan. And since I didn't have a visa, I didn't have a I wasn't using my passport. That was complicated. You know, if you were stopped or arrested, they would possibly take my film and put me in jail. So what I did is I put the film in the seams of my clothing and sometimes in areas on my body, which if they were looking through my camera bag and they took film from the camera bag and made sure that that film wasn't my exposed film and that the good film was somewhere on my person in a pocket that was sewn up and you couldn't readily see it. So I was very careful because after basically risking my life, I didn't want to lose my film. And I got arrested a couple times. I got put in jail twice. And
by whom?
Well, when I came back into Pakistan, they caught me. They saw us walking in this village, and they stopped us. Who are you, and where are you coming from? And you know, why are you in this desolate place? So we told them, you know, we're basically reporting on the war. And of course, they didn't necessarily believe us, so they took us to the police station, and then they kept us in jail for some period of time until they could verify who we were, that we weren't, you know, gun runners or spies or whatever, or drug, you know, dealing in drugs. Yeah, that was always a problem, getting arrested going in and then getting arrested coming out. I spent 5 days in jail in one place in Pakistan, which wasn't fun because there was no – they didn't have beds to sleep on. You had to bribe the guards to bring you food. It wasn't fun.
But you managed to take the photos home. You managed to put the human face on this conflict, as you have described it earlier on. And these photos, they have been published in the New York Times magazine and Time magazine and in many, many others, giving a big push to your career, I would say. And after that, you ended up also covering many more areas of international conflict and crisis, for example, in Beirut, in Cambodia, Philippines, the Gulf War, former Yugoslavia, Tibet, Syria, Iraq, etc., etc. What has drawn you to such challenging assignments and projects in conflict and war zones again and again after this initial experience?
I think what kept drawing me back to these various places was, first of all, these were countries and regions that were in a pivotal part of their history, that things were shifting. Two sides were locked in this death struggle. People were trying to become liberated from the central government. So again, there was this human story, the displaced people, the refugees, people being wounded. And I think that this was a story which had to be told. I felt it was that the world needed to be needed to be informed about what was going on. I mean, how else do we learn about what's happening in the world apart from whether it's people in radio or newspapers or TV or photographers? The people who tell us what's happening in our world are the journalists and the photographers and the TV crews and whatnot. So I wanted to be part of that tribe that was telling the story of what was happening in this world. And I think looking at places like what was happening in Cambodia with the Khmer Rouge and Sri Lanka with the Tamil Tigers, I mean, this was changing the course of that country's history. And I wanted to have a kind of a front row seat to witness these historic events.
Did you hope to have a specific effect through your photography back then? Did you have a message? Did you hope for international support or peacekeeping missions, anything like this? Or was your primary focus really to inform in a journalistic fashion?
I think my motivation was to inform, to give, you know, a voice to the voiceless, to tell these stories about places which... I mean, we needed to know that thousands of Afghan villages were being destroyed. I mean, this was like a crime against humanity. I mean, this was outrageous. Look at what they did in Cambodia, the Khmer Rouge killing like millions of people. Yeah,
yes.
This was – I felt like my role in a very small way was to help to tell the story, to get this information out to people. So I was kind of driven to go. And then the Gulf War, the first Gulf War, with this ecological disaster, this environmental catastrophe, with hundreds of oil wells spewing smoke and oil into the atmosphere, and the damage it did to the Gulf area. I mean, this again had to be told. That story had to be told, and we needed to solve that problem. So I think that was my main motivation. I'm still interested in telling stories about disadvantaged people and the plight of refugees or people who are suffering in certain ways, or animals that have been neglected and abused and tortured.
As you have done with your current book, which doesn't focus on torturing animals or tortured animals, but on animals themselves. Maybe we have time later on to talk about it. It's a very beautiful anthology of many, many projects that you have done, including animals. But you talked about the purpose of showing these conflicts and the suffering. When you see a heartbreaking scene like that and a person in despair, how do you make the decision on whether to take a photo and if it is moral to take one or not?
Well, I think you always have to ask yourself when you're confronted with a situation, you know, moment to moment, is this the right thing to do? Am I being respectful? Am I invading this person's privacy? If I was in their place, would I want to be photographed? And I think you always have to evaluate what you're doing moment to moment. Maybe you're in, there's been loss of life and people invite you in to photograph it because they want the world to know what's going on. But then maybe after some time, things change and you have to stop and put your camera away. It's always something which you have to really have that in the back of your mind, that small voice saying, you know, am I being respectful? Am I giving people their dignity? And if I was in their place, you know, what would I want done to me?
You published a book together with your sister Bonnie not too long ago. It's called Life in Pictures, and it's written by your sister Bonnie. And one thing that she mentions in the book is, I think, pretty interesting. She remarks on the fact that while much of your work shows dangerous and rather violent places, strangely, all the photos others have taken of you while you are working on these assignments, they show you grin. Why do you think is that?
Show
you grinning.
Oh, grinning, yeah.
While you're working in these challenging circumstances.
I don't know. I think whenever you're self-aware or when somebody's pointing a camera at you, I think your first sort of nervous, self-conscious feeling or your reaction is maybe to smile or something. Maybe that's why I seem to be. I know when I meet people on the street and ask them if I can make a portrait, they tend to be sort of taken aback and yes. And sort of, you know, why me? And there's a little bit of nervousness and self-consciousness and often they kind of grin, trying to put on this mask, putting their best foot forward. And sometimes you have to wait for people to relax and to calm down, and then it becomes more real and more genuine. So I don't know why I'm grinning, and maybe I'm just was embarrassed to be photographed.
Or maybe I read it in a way that it is probably showing you being really in a zone of deep comfort while following or pursuing your work, that no matter what the circumstances, that if you really hook onto a subject, onto a topic, you are in such a zone within yourself where you just feel very comfortable.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to be said for when you're out on the street with your camera, you get into this sort of meditative state. You get into a zone where you're right there in the moment. And you're not thinking about, you know, yesterday or tomorrow or what I'm going to have for lunch. You're fully absorbed in your surroundings, and you notice that you're hypersensitive and aware of what's happening to you on the street. You see things which perhaps other people would just pass by and wouldn't notice. Your sense of observation is kind of heightened. And then you can start to see things. You can see light and compositions and you know, kind of human behavior. And also having practiced, being in this sort of almost meditative practice for, you know, decades, I think you learn, you're able to get in that zone in a much quicker, deeper way just through that, just by virtue of the fact that you've practiced and done this for so many years.
You've just described how you try to explore a new place and how you perceive the light and all the details. How does it work for you when you arrive in a new place today, a new city, a new street? How do you usually try to find your access and your perspective on this place? Have you, over the years, developed any habits in this regard?
Well, I think initially when you get to a new place, it's best to approach it very carefully. You walk, maybe you have your camera, but you walk around. You're not really looking for pictures. You're not thinking about photography. You're just trying to get the vibe of the place, trying to understand how this place ticks. And I think it's just to slowly kind of ease into it and try and appreciate, meet some people and just kind of wander around and start to understand what is it about this place that's unique, that's special, what's particular about, what makes this place different? What makes Kathmandu or Madrid or Buenos Aires or the, whatever, what makes these places unique? What makes them special? What's unique about a place like Texas versus Tibet? And then try and dig deeper into that and just sort of start to find the soul of a place. What is it about this place that's unique? What's the uniqueness of a person or a place?
Do you think that this exploration of a place and this attempt to really feel the place, that it would be as intense and enriching for you if you wouldn't have a camera with you, if you just would do it without this additional motivation? Because I find that when I'm in a place to write a book and to try to do research and to feel the essence, find out about some interesting people or story, some random person that I can talk to on the street, it pushes me. It pushes me not necessarily out of the comfort zone in every situation. It's not always about that. But sometimes it just pushes me to go out for another half an hour and walk the street because who knows what happens. Well, maybe if I would just be there for myself, I would take it easy and have a drink in the evening or whatever.
Yeah. Well, I think the camera is an excuse. It's a way to, you have this tool, you go out and that's your purpose with the camera, to go out and photograph. You go out early in the morning, you're out probably the whole day. It's like a diary. You're making kind of notes. It's like a sketch pad. And you're looking around. What's fascinating about this place or that place or a crack in the wall or a dog that runs by? And you kind of fill up your sketchbook and you can go back at the end of the day and look through and see what you've accomplished, what's working and what isn't. And then you have that picture, that sketch, and now it's just frozen in time and you can kind of go back to it for the rest of your life and remember that day in Kathmandu or in Calcutta and all the memories of that day and that picture. You just, it's always with you. It always stays with you. You don't, the memory doesn't fade because you have that piece of evidence. You have that memory kind of locked in that frame of your picture. So, what is it about the place that you want to remember? What is it about this place that's significant? As you walk through the streets, what individuals really impressed me? People that I wanted to remember, people that I think their face tells a story. So this is kind of where I think with the camera, it's this way to kind of lock in the memory of these travels. And then you can learn so much. I mean, once you look at the picture, you can start to see things that maybe you didn't really even recognize when you were shooting. You come back, you look, you start discovering things in the picture, which in that split second you hadn't really seen. But now that you can look at the picture, you know, you start discovering all sorts of wonderful things.
And you remember a lot of enriching context, as you have just described. However, I know about you that when you publish your photos, you hesitate and often refrain from providing too much context about the photo, despite the fact that you call yourself or that you are called a visual storyteller. Why do you think it is important not to give too much context to those who look at the photo but didn't actually make the experience?
Well, I think in photography, in picture making, how you frame it, what you include, what you exclude, the time of day, it's just a way to create a feeling, an emotional response to what you're seeing, what's in front of you. What's the best way to tell that story? I think emotion is one of the most important things in photography, perhaps in art. You know, love, hate, different emotions, happiness, joy, love. I think these are the things which we, in the case of love and happiness, is what we live for. Beauty, I think, without, you know, this is what's gives us the what's important in life. So this is what I kind of want to convey. And however I can frame something and the information I include in the picture to help tell that story is how I want to work.
So it's about the expression of emotion and humanity, but not so much about your own personal associations with the photo.
Well, I think when I'm out there on the street, I'm telling kind of my story. I'm showing what moves me, what's important to me. What is it about this person or this place which I feel was memorable? And I guess I'm trying to tell in a way my story and show things, go to places which kind of move me, and which in some ways, whether it's trying to make the world a better place or trying to, you know, show the positive aspects at times of this planet and people and whatnot, the incredible wonderment of animals. And, you know, I was with the lemurs in Madagascar or with penguins in Antarctica. And it's how is this possible? How on the same planet we have this array of animals? It's just, it just kind of blows my mind to think of, you know, the elephants. And then on the other hand, you have bears and whatnot. I find it, for me, it's one of the most important things in my life to see these things.
The differences regarding places, the uniqueness, that's what you described earlier on. And you mentioned, for example, Kathmandu, and uniqueness brings me to another question, because if you want to try to show something unique, it's also very easy to show cliché and to get into the habit of showing clichés. So, example, if I think of Kathmandu or Nepal in general or Burma, it seems quite obvious to show monks seemingly lost in contemplation and in contentment. How do you think about cliché and when it is helpful and when or how you try to avoid them?
I think the challenge is to go to a place that's been photographed a million times and to come with your own vision, your own idea, to look at it in a different way. That's the challenge. I find that fascinating, to go to a place, Taj Mahal or whatever, and to how can I see this? Let me look at it in my own way and try and do something different. Look at it in a new way. Because we've seen the Taj Mahal. We've seen the Eiffel Tower. We've seen different things around the world. So we don't need to see that again. We want to see something, a new perspective. That's the challenge. Because these are important places. They're cliches because people continually talk about these places, go to these places. I mean, Venice has been photographed a million times. Millions of tourists go there every year. What story can I tell about Venice that's new, a new angle?
So it doesn't put you off necessarily, but encourages you to take up the challenge?
Absolutely. You know, I want to experience Venice for myself. It's one of the most important, interesting cities in the world. I don't want to do the same old pictures that everybody else has. I want to tell how this moves me personally. What is it about Venice that I think is important, and do it in my own way? That's the challenge, because we don't need to see another picture of, you know, a gondola in a canal. It's just that we've seen that a zillion times. People are bored. It's not going to register. So that's the, I think you want to put your own signature, your own voice, and tell your story about that place.
I'd like to take one step back to Afghanistan once more and to the many other conflicts that you have covered. How have all the crises and all the tragedies that you have witnessed affected you and how you think about humanity? How have you prevented yourself from becoming a cynic, for example?
After witnessing all this kind of death and destruction from all these various places, and then seeing where we're at now in the world with climate change, racism, which persists, I think it's hard to be optimistic. I do think we have to try and make the world a better place and do our, I think everybody needs to pitch in and help in various ways. But, you know, it's the forces of evil persist and are strong. I look in my country, the U.S., it's hard to imagine that we're at this point when there's still people denying climate change. Racism is rampant. We've wasted literally trillions of dollars in Iraq and Afghanistan, trillions of dollars which could have helped in education and healthcare, and our crumbling infrastructure. And it's just almost criminal how we've squandered all of our resources, and thousands of or millions of lives have been lost. It's just hard to imagine. You look at the fires in Australia, you look at the fires in Brazil, the conflict in the Middle East, you look at what's happening in Iran, in Iraq, you look at these various governments around the world which are moving in very dangerous directions. With the world's in a critical place right now. I look at my country, the United States, and I look at the trillions of dollars which have been squandered, wasted on fighting these unnecessary conflicts in Iraq, Afghanistan, trying to be the policeman of the world with, you know, untold bases everywhere. I mean, we just have to get our priorities straightened out and realize that things like healthcare, education can't be neglected. We have to do the right thing and put our resources in these very necessary places.
What have you learned about human resilience in these many conflict zones?
Well, you know, I've learned so much about resilience, and you know, I look at what's happened in Afghanistan, for instance, and it's just remarkable how people can be beaten down. You know, their villages can be bombed. They have to leave in a hurry and live as refugees, and yet they bounce back, and they do it often with a smile on their face. And they keep moving forward. I guess there's no option. I mean, but people, you know, legs are blown off. People lose limbs, and they just adapt. They move forward with kind of fortitude and great determination. And you really have to admire people in these kind of situations and how they've overcome adversity.
Is this something, this resilience that you also saw in these now very famous piercing green eyes of the young girl that ended up being known around the world as the Afghan girl? Or could that be too much interpretation?
Well, I think the look, I mean, the photograph I made of the Afghan girl in 1984, I think there is this her look in her eye, which I think I kind of interpret it as sort of a dignity, kind of a forward, kind of a fortitude, a way of she's not going to let this defeat her. She's very direct. Her eyes are open, very proud, very dignified. And I think that that picture inspired people all over the world that, you know, here's a country that's being in this state of war, and people by the millions were driven out into neighboring countries. And yet their head is held high, and they're going to move forward and do the best they can to have a meaningful life. Incidentally, with the Afghan girl, we for years have been helping her and her family with her daughter's education, with healthcare. And we've...
You mean years after the photo has been taken, like today? Yeah, you didn't know her before then.
Right. Yeah. Since we rediscovered the Afghan girl.
And maybe we can put these a little bit into chronological order. First of all, I guess I am correct in assuming that you have given almost no interview for many, many years without having to talk about the Afghan girl. Is that right?
That's true, yeah.
Does it annoy you after all these years?
No, I think it's an important story. I think her story in some ways represents other Afghans, the country of Afghanistan, her resilience, her fortitude, the dignity which she exhibited, and the way she was able to keep her family together. And I think she was heroic in her way, her actions and what she did with her family. I think it's really to be commended. Since we rediscovered her, since we found her after 17 years and we were reintroduced to her, we have helped her in every possible way. We bought her a home. We helped her family and education and healthcare. So we've try to support her in every possible way, and we just hope the best for her.
Her name is Shabat Gula, and you took the photo in 84, and it was on the National Geographic cover in 85, I believe, and has become really iconic for those listeners who don't know it. Just Google it. It's without any doubt one of the best known photos in the 20th century. And you already talked a little bit about the political situation at that time in Afghanistan. Was that still impacted, the situation back then, by the invasion? Was this still within the context of the situation that you were there this time, or did you have a different assignment?
When I took that picture?
Yes.
Well, I went in 1984, I went to do kind of a major story on the Afghan-Pakistan border. At that time, there were still millions of people, millions of Afghans fleeing their country because of the bombing. And they were going to Iran, they were going to Tajikistan, they were going to Pakistan, they were going to India. And I wanted to see what it's like, what's life like on the border. And I spent 3 months on the Pakistan side, I went into Afghanistan. And during that time, I was in a refugee camp in Pakistan. I just happened to be walking down this road, and I heard voices coming from this school. So I decided to kind of check it out. I went in, I asked the teacher if I could observe, if I could photograph. I had a permission from the camp, of course. So I went in, and I immediately saw this little girl who, with this incredible look, these incredible eyes, and I knew that this was going to be an important photograph. So I kind of thought, I plotted, I schemed, how's the best way to approach her? I don't want to frighten her. And so I came up with a plan, and I photographed some of the other girls, and she agreed. A little bit reluctant because...
So first you took all the other photos to make her relax.
Yeah, I photographed some of the other students. I wanted to show her that this was okay, that this wasn't going to create any harm. And the other girls seemed to enjoy it. It was kind of fun. And then I came to her, and then because she had seen everybody else being photographed, she agreed. And in that culture, parents are very happy to have you photograph their young girls before puberty. So a girl at 10 or 11 or 12 is still completely permissible to photograph her. So she was at that pre-puberty age, and so it was perfectly fine to photograph her according to their customs. And she just had this incredible look. The light was right. The background was right. What she was wearing and the color of the background. It was just like one of these perfect situations when all the stars aligned in this kind of perfect order. All I had to do was just try and get the picture in focus, and everything else sort of took care of itself. And I didn't see the picture. I didn't see the developed roll of film for, I think, about 2 months. And when I got back...
During all this time, did you know, were you like really curious and almost dying to see it? Or were you just like, oh, probably it was good, but we'll just be like the other good photos I took this time?
Well, I knew the picture was special, but the moment after I finished photographing her...
Which only took a few minutes, right?
Yeah, it was maybe 2 or 3 minutes. And there was all this commotion in the room, and girls were running around, laughing, joking, dust was flying around. So after I finished, I left the school, and I went back to my hotel because it was around lunchtime, and I went on to other things. I didn't really think about it at all for about 2 months until I got home and looked through the film and saw the picture, and I realized that this was like, it really worked. You know, the expression, the exposure, the light.
The colors, of course.
The colors were amazing. It just happened to be she wore this red shawl. The tent in the background was sort of a green. The color combination was really, really wonderful. So there were a couple variations. There was one of her with her hands up to her face. She was kind of shy, and she was kind of hiding behind her hands. And then the teacher said, you know, this is like we need to show the world what's happening to us. So let's help and cooperate with this photographer because our country's been overrun, our village, we've all had to flee for our lives. We're living in this sort of terrible refugee camp. I mean, we want the world to know, we want help. And so that was part of the impetus for all the cooperation.
The teacher really encouraged her to help you tell the story, and in this case specifically to take her hands down from her face.
Yeah. I'd already photographed other students in the class. I photographed the teacher. So it was she didn't really have to coax her very much, and it was fine. And I think that the look in her expression, I think, has to do partly to the fact that she had never been photographed in her life. This was the first time she was photographed. And I also think that, you know, the camera and looking at me, this kind of funny man dressed in a different kind of a costume and speaking a different language, it was all probably very curious for her. And I think she was amused by the whole thing, the tripod and everything. It was probably very strange. I think that was had a little bit of her expression could have had a bit of curiosity in addition to the horror of being an orphan, a refugee living in this, growing up in this village in Afghanistan, then suddenly you're in this refugee camp. It must have been very unsettling, disturbing to be in this kind of strange environment.
And this mixture that many people believe they see in this photo, all these components of her fate, do you think this is one of the main reasons indeed for this huge impact the photo had internationally? I mean, you also have done many, many other very powerful portraits before and after you took this one, but this one became an icon worldwide.
I think there's a beauty to it. I think there's ambiguity to it. I think that her expression, it's not overtly sad. It's not particularly happy. It's some kind of a neutral look where you can kind of interpret it in your own way. She has this really intense look. So there's a lot of kind of emotions, I think, going on in the picture in a lot of ways, a lot of different ways you can look at it and kind of interpret it in the way that you know you want. If we didn't know she was a refugee, I still think there's a power to the picture. Knowing that she's an orphan and a refugee, it adds to the drama of the picture. But I don't know. I just think that this sort of mix of emotions and questions about, you know, what's going, what's she thinking, her expression, her mouth. We don't really know what's inside of, you know. So there's all these questions and kind of, I think, which helps to add to the interest in the picture.
How did this picture then develop a life of its own from then on to become as iconic as it did?
I think it started in magazines all over the world, literally all over the world. A picture was in covers of magazines talking about Afghanistan. Then it started to be published in photography magazines, and then it became published in other kinds of magazines. It wasn't news, it wasn't photography, it was just other reasons. And it never let up. We've gotten thousands of requests over the years for educational purposes, textbooks, you know, medical purposes. And it's a picture which people are continually intrigued by. whether it's the mystery or the ambiguity of it or the beauty of her expression, this young girl with this kind of wide-eyed look. The one thing is that her face, it's clear that she's comes from kind of a poor background. Her face is a bit dirty. Her hair is kind of messed up. Her shawl has a rip in it. You can tell that this is a girl that doesn't have a lot. It's probably her only shawl that she has. She has to wear it even with the hole in it. So I think that adds to the interest of the picture. She's clearly not a model. There's a genuine, authentic quality to her expression. It's hard to duplicate that look. I think people have tried, but it doesn't quite work. Whether if you're trying to duplicate it with a model, or it's just that there's something about the elements coming together in some perfect unison, which just is kind of hard to replicate.
You already have mentioned that after 17 years that you wanted to see if you can find her again, to go back and try to find her. Why did you want to do that?
Well, after 9/11 in New York, you know, and we realized that part of this plan to bomb New York and other places was hatched in Afghanistan by bin Laden and al-Qaeda. So suddenly the world's attention, the eyes were back on Afghanistan, suddenly people who had never heard of Afghanistan. So I decided to go back with a filmmaker and do a documentary about Afghanistan after the invasion, the American invasion after 9/11. And part of what we wanted to show was this Afghan girl and what happened to her. People were wondering, like, what happened to that girl? Who is she? So we decided to go back and actually look for her and to see what's her life like now. Did she survive? And what's her story? So we went back and
it was not easy to find her.
It was a miracle that we found her. I never in a million years believed we would actually find her, because she's a woman, women are covered. She could have been living in a very remote village and there'd be no way to find her, to research the situation. It could have been days to walk. And then how would you put the picture together with the person now? I mean, it was just an impossibility.
Why did you even try it then?
Well, we thought, you know, we might get lucky. Let's see if we can find the school where I had photographed her. And went to the school. We found the teacher, which was encouraging. We showed her picture around to like literally hundreds of people in the camp. And for days and days and days, nobody recognized her, no information. We got kind of discouraged. Other girls, other women at that age started claiming that they were the Afghan girl because they suspected there was some opportunity here. There was money or something. And so all these people were saying, oh, yeah, I'm the girl, I'm the girl. But the eyes didn't match. Nothing matched. So we kept looking. And then somebody came up and said, you know what? I don't know where she is, but I know her brother. And I can find her brother for you. But he's living in a village that's, you know, miles away. He said, I need some money to go there. And we thought, okay, yeah, the guy, he'll take the money. We'll never see him again. But we decided to take a chance. And we gave him the money for the bus trip. Like 3 days later, he came back, not only with a brother, but with Shorbat Gula.
And the girl herself.
And then, boom, the story had this incredible ending. We found her. We verified that it was her, went to an eye doctor, basically did some retinal checks, and it was her. And so we suddenly realized, okay, this is amazing. You know, now we want to help you. How can we help you? What can we do to you? What can we do for you to help you make your life better?
Did she know how famous her portrait from 1984 had become worldwide? Or was this a complete news to her?
Well, she's illiterate. I think she's still illiterate. So she wasn't familiar. She didn't read magazines or newspapers. She didn't have a television. She didn't have any idea about magazines, especially international magazines. She had never seen that photograph of herself. She didn't know anything about any magazine anywhere in the world. So when we found her again and we showed her the magazine and whatnot, she was completely baffled and surprised and I think kind of indifferent, because she probably didn't understand the significance, probably didn't understand that her picture had been reproduced literally millions and millions of times. It was only after we started to when she saw the documentary and she saw herself on television and the story, then she understood that, you know, this was kind of a big deal. And that and especially also when we started helping to support her and her family, and then she realized that, well, there's a really wonderful benefit by having, you know, my picture in this magazine. I think it changed her life for the better. I mean, certainly, suddenly, their financial situation was solved. She was able to send her girls to school. Her health care needs were met. And we bought her a home to live in.
And you did all of that because, of course, you yourself also benefited from the portrait so much.
Yeah, we wanted to give back. We wanted to help her. It just seemed to me that her picture had been published so much and we had all benefited from it, that she should also benefit from it too. So this was like a logical, the right thing to do.
You have photographed so many charismatic faces. You have provided so many insights into cultures and wars and places. What is left for you to show that you haven't really shown already?
Well, I think it's always interesting to go back to some of the same places you've already been to see how the place has changed. You're going there with another frame of mind. The world's changing so rapidly that the way the place looked, take Kathmandu, for instance. When I was there, just outside the city was countryside. There were rice fields. That's all gone. It's just one big urban sprawl. China, when I first started traveling there in the early 80s, has been transformed. It just makes your head spin to see how that's changed, as has India. Russia, which I really couldn't travel to, is now open. I can go there pretty much anytime I want to. It's fascinating. So I want to go back and kind of see the changes in places like Russia and China. I'd like to explore some of this country, the U.S. I've spent so many years in other parts of the world. I'd like to kind of explore my own country. And I'd like to go to some places that I haven't gone to. I'd love to go to some place in South America, Peru, Bolivia. I'd like to go to Central Asia, Tajikistan and Uzbekistan. And Turkmenistan. I mean, some of these places I think would be fascinating to see for myself.
You have talked about the changes and the transformations that you have witnessed in many places, like, for example, Kathmandu. How do you feel about these changes? Are you sad about them? Do you perceive that some cultures, for example, are becoming more and more similar, more and more alike, that uniqueness is being lost? Or are you less melancholic if you look at the changes that you've seen?
Well, I think regional differences, I think, are great. I think the personality, the way we dress, our music, our food, architecture, I think these have been developed over, you know, hundreds of thousands of years. And our differences should be celebrated and preserved. What's happened in many cases, take China, for instance, they've ripped down so many of their old buildings. A lot of the architecture now looks like you could be anywhere in the world. You know, the advent of all these fast food restaurants all over the world. I think it's a pity. I think that you look at how we dress now is all becoming so kind of uniform and homogenous. And globalization is really kind of taking over. And so you know, you can be in Cleveland or Osaka or, you know, Hamburg or Buenos Aires or whatever, and it's all starting to look exactly the same.
Same applies to the food often.
Yeah, I've been in very remote places in Nepal, in Mali. Recently, I was in Papua New Guinea. and you go into these places which are way off the beaten track, and they, you know, they have Nike shoes and they have, you know, a t-shirt that says, you know, Florida, I mean, like Harvard or something. And this globalization thing is really kind of taking over. And a lot of what they wore, which was perfectly fine, a turban or some kind of a local, is being discarded because they all want to look modern. Kids want to be like other kids in the world and wear the certain kind of fashion. So, and this kind of the wardrobe also applies to food and to music, architecture. So the world is going to eventually just be like one sort of glass and steel structure, like a one big airport, and all the local flavor and the individuality and the personality of a particular place, it might be lost.
That sounds pretty pessimistic.
Well, I think that's the reality. I think that's what we're looking at. You know, just drive throughout the countryside and a lot of countries, and it's just really boring. There's no sense of aesthetics or beauty, or there's no kind of charm. It's just about commerce. And I think it's sad. I think that, you know, we want our lives to be full of, to be enriched and to be pleasurable as much as possible. And it seems to me, if you can put some thought into particularly architecture, you can come up with something which is, which has a, you know,
relates
beauty
to the place and the context of where it is being built, for example,
yeah.
Right?
I was recently in Havana. Some of the old architecture is being preserved, and some of it's being ripped down and replaced by just, you know, glass and steel structure, like a box with no personality, no charm. Do we want to live in that kind of world? Is that where we're going? I'm not sure.
Despite these developments, of course, you continue to travel. You continue to be curious. Probably just means that your job is a little bit harder today as compared to some decades ago to find these unique moments and spots.
Well, I think every place has a story, even when they've ripped down a place to make way for some ugly building. I think even that's a story. So I'm not just looking for quaint, old places that have charm. But I do think that that's our past. And I don't think we want to turn our back on what kind of brought us to this point. And I think we want to have some connection to the past. That's the great thing about photography. It shows us the way we were, how we looked at one time, how we dressed. And it shows us where we came from, our history. And I think it's really important to have that memory, that document of how we evolved since photography's been around. Otherwise, what's the point? I think we have to try and make a world that we, you know, that is beautiful, that's functional, of course, but that has some kind of charm and some kind of the place to where you actually is uplifting, that is enriching, that makes our spirits soar, I think this is what we should endeavor to make this kind of a world to live in.
When you look back on your portfolio of decades of work today, is this part of the reason that you might feel pleased with your own work, with your own legacy thus far, that you have been able to capture these moments, not only of suffering, which we talked quite a bit about, but also of beauty and enrichment? Is this something that is important to you if you look back? I mean, some of these photos are a few decades old and they show the past today.
Yeah, some of my work shows a world that no longer exists. I think of, you know, steam engines in India or the way people dressed in Tibet. It's gone. And in some cases, these things I photographed are just disappeared and they'll never come back. So this is a record of that. This is a document. And I think there's great value in that. I think that this is the archive, my body of work, although I didn't set off to be a historian or an anthropologist, but I think that just my curiosity and my kind of wandering eye to kind of the curiosity I had in my life and the wanting to see these places and document it, I think has left a kind of a record of a world which it has changed, and we can celebrate our past and hope to maybe to try and do better in the future to, you know, preserve our world, the good parts of our world.
In an interview you gave a while ago, you said, quote, "I don't want to be pigeonholed. I think it's important to keep evolving and experimenting and reinventing yourself. Otherwise, it's like hitting a drum, the same note over and over again. I think you should want to grow, to evolve, to change, try different things," unquote. Which advice would you have on how to think about evolving and growing like this?
Well, I think you want to continue to photograph and learn about new things, not just get in a kind of a rut and say, you know, I do a certain kind of street photography or portraiture or examining the ethnicity of the world and cultures. Let me try something new. Let me expand my vision and photograph in possibly a different way or a different kind of subject that maybe I haven't explored in the past. Otherwise, it's just you're just repeating yourself, and I think then that becomes stale and boring, and you don't want to be keep covering the same ground over and over again. That's why I spent kind of many years photographing these areas of conflict and war zones or refugees, or I kind of feel like maybe I can make a contribution to the world in a different way now. Maybe I don't have to do exactly that. Maybe I can make a contribution about the environment or wildlife or something. So I think you got to grow and kind of stretch yourself and not become complacent.
Not only in photography, but in general in life, I guess.
Yeah, I have a 3-year-old daughter now, which is the best thing that ever happened to me in my life. And that's a learning experience. Every day is a discovery. Every day is something new. It's amazing. So, yeah, again, I think we need to continue to grow. And I think that keeps you young. I think physically I feel great. And I think a lot of that has to do with that I'm just not sedentary. I'm moving. I'm active. I'm climbing and jumping and running and everything.
And looking for inspiration and new ideas and new projects constantly.
So yeah, I go through my archive literally every day. I'm always looking through my past work, and so I want to do something new. I want to do something different. I want to add. I want to extend my body of work to new places and new ideas and new subjects, and not kind of till the same ground over and over again. Life is short. You know, I think you really have to make use of the time that we have here, because, you know, the years just fly by, and I don't want to squander what little time I have left. I want to make it count. That's kind of my sort of mantra at the moment.
And this is almost a very nice way to conclude our conversation. At the very end, I would like to do a little lightning round of questions.
Sure.
Doesn't mean your answer needs to be super short. Just means that my question is a little bit shorter, and we see how we go, if you're fine with that.
Sure.
I was happiest while traveling in?
I think I was happiest traveling in Cuba with my family. I think it was a chance to explore a new place, and also a chance to share it with people I love. I think that that's the ultimate, to be able to do the work and also share it with somebody that you care about.
Probably the biggest danger I exposed myself for a photo.
Oh, the biggest danger that I exposed myself to as a photographer was absolutely this ill-advised flight in Slovenia, where we crashed.
Was it Yugoslavia?
Yeah, it was in Yugoslavia in the in Slovenia, mm-hmm. near Ljubljana. At the time, it was called Yugoslavia. And we crashed this plane. Well, I was a passenger, and we crashed in this lake, and I came within a hair of being killed. And I thought, you know, I'm going to die for some aerial pictures of a. It was, you know, it's a. I've always been very wary of small aircraft and helicopters ever since then.
But pretty happy after the crash, probably, because to your own surprise, yeah, you were still alive.
Yeah, I was lucky to survive. It was just very lucky. Yeah.
Did the others survive?
No, there was myself and the pilot. He got out.
Okay.
He got out before I did.
Yeah.
And he wasn't much help in getting me out, so I was a little upset about that.
Not the archetype of a captain that leaves the sinking ship last.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
One of the saddest situations I found myself in while doing my work.
I think one of the saddest moments was working in a Red Cross hospital in Kabul, Afghanistan, when the city was under rocket attack. And it was so depressing and tragic to see dozens of people coming in, wounded, missing limbs, people were dead, coming to this hospital just in waves. That was, you really saw the damage that war can do when you see the hallways of this hospital just lined up with people, injured people. It was just devastating.
I consider my body of work around the monsoon as some of my most meaningful work because?
Well, I think the monsoon is a powerful body of work because there's so much drama. You know, the monsoon, there's either too much rain or not enough rain. There's either flooding or drought. A farmer can lose his entire crop by flood or by lack of rain. So, and that they depend on this crop for their livelihood. So there's a lot of drama. Cities, towns get flooded. People get stranded in their homes. The torrential rain when it comes down really is so dramatic. And to witness that and to try and photograph this is one of the most dramatic, I think, weather phenomenon that we have in the world.
Drama, but also, of course, it provides life, right? It creates new potential for new life, for new crops or whatever.
Yeah, the monsoon renews life. Yes. It brings relief to the heat, grows the crops. So it's vital in that part of the world, a good monsoon is. And it can be also deadly. I mean, landslides, I mean, whole villages can get washed away. So it can be kind of life-giving, but it can also be also tragic.
What is the essence of what traveling gives to you?
I think traveling is a great way to learn about the world. If you're curious, you have a sense of adventure, you want to see what mysteries and what amazing places and people are living in this world. I want to see everything. You know, I want to see the Grand Canyon. I want to see the Gobi Desert. I want to go to Red Square. I want to see the pyramids. I want to be in a monastery in China or Japan. You know, I want to see Antarctica. I want to go to the Arctic. I want to see a polar bear. I mean, what else am I going to do with my life? I mean, this to me is the most enriching thing I can do is to see this planet, meet people, and get a sense of the entirety of the world. I want to go everywhere.
What would you do if you were only allowed or able to go on to one more trip?
Well, if I were to go to one trip, I think I'd probably go to Italy. I think Italy has a combination of great beauty, great food, great wine, wonderful people. I think the history, the layers of history are evident, and you can see the landscape, the mountains. You can really see a glimpse into the past. I think Italy would be my choice.
What do you consider as your greatest success so far?
Well, I think having my daughter, and that's kind of a cliche, but I think that's probably the best part of my life. Of course, my wife and my family. But I think that's the most important thing you can do is to have a child and try and teach that child about life and then try and have that person grow up to be somebody who's good and make a contribution. You know, I think that's probably the best. I mean, of course, accumulating my archive and having this look at the world, this kind of time capsule in this 50-year time. There's incredible things happened in my lifetime. You know, you think of all the history that's taken place. So to be a witness to that, to be on the periphery of a lot of events, has been a real privilege to be able to do that.
What is a common misconception about your work or you?
Well, I think photography or any art, any occupation, there's just a lot of work. And it appears to be, oh, you just run around and take a few pictures here and there. There's actually a lot of effort and time and discipline that's involved in anything that you do worthwhile. So I think any craft that you dedicate your life to and try and work at the highest level, you know, year after year. I mean, that's a kind of a big deal, I think, in terms of honing your skill. Again, whether you're an athlete or an architect or a doctor or a musician or a dancer or a teacher, I think in time you start to understand things and you become much more skilled at your profession, your craft, and it's sort of magic can happen at some point, and you're able to dig deep and understand things, which only comes about by, you know, years of concentration, hard work, discipline, and wonderful things can happen when you put in that kind of effort and time.
Do you feel today that this kind of magic comes to you easily as soon as you pick up the camera, or is it still as hard as in the beginning?
I don't think it's any easier. I think I have a certain confidence now that that I can get the wheels moving and something wonderful hopefully will happen. I think when you're young, without that confidence, you tend to be a little bit more nervous or a little bit more stressed. But I think in time you realize that, you know, that well, it just continually flows if you know, protect it and don't. Again, if you get into a rut, you could potentially lose that muse that whispers into your ear. I think you have to, that's why you want to refresh yourself and get out of your comfort zone.
Is there anything else, anything additional that you'd like to share with our listeners? Any advice that you would like to extend to them? Probably they are interested in you and in your work and your legacy. That's why they're listening.
Well, I think it's always fascinating to look at an artist who's spent 50 years or 60 years and see how their vision of the world. And I think that's in my case, I've traveled all over the world and I've dug really deeply into different cultures. I think that's fascinating to see, whether it's my work or the work of, you know, Elliot Erwitt or Henri Cartier-Bresson, or to see, you know, one person's vision of the world and what they saw, what they witnessed, I think is a fascinating tale to tell and to listen to.
I agree. It was very fascinating for me to listen to you. And I thank you very much for the generous time you took for me. Thank you so much, Steve. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you. It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.